right, everybody. Good afternoon. Everybody have a good break? It's been a week since we've been here, right? Looks like nothing due this week. The Chapter 2 Mastering Chemistry will be due at the end of next week. So the thing you should be preparing for, I guess, over this weekend will be the first quiz then, which will be on Monday. So up through material that we'll cover in today's class. So go through today's notes and practice that sort of stuff in the end of chapter problems, for instance. Go through those worksheets I have on my webpage for doing conversions with density and with SI prefixes and stuff like that. So it's probably just going to be a pretty short quiz. Probably be like two questions where you'll have to show your work doing calculations. It'll be that sort of thing. So expect something where you're converting SI prefixes. Expect something with densities involved, something like that, I think, at least. Okay, so practice up on those sort of things. You do need to have those SI prefixes memorized. I will not provide those for you, but if there are any other conversion factors that are needed, I will provide those. So I'll tell you what it is to go from inches to centimeters or something like that, but I will not tell you what it is to go from centimeters to meters. Does that make sense? Okay, so the spreadsheet to Excel file was due yesterday in the Dropbox. If you haven't submitted it yet, put it in the Late Labs Dropbox as soon as possible. We are doing microscale density next week, so get your notebook prepared for that. I will be looking at notebooks before we begin next time. So, and you know, take a look on the webpage on the laboratory notebook information link that we have there if you don't know what to do for your pre-lab notebook. So so have that prepared. Come with the procedure actually printed out. Otherwise, that's about it. There have been some good posts in the discussion boards on D2L. I've been keeping up with that and participating a little bit myself here and there. So who has questions? I think we should be pretty straightforward so far. Nothing too complicated. Yeah.
I posted in the discussion board this morning, but do you know if you're going to be able to get grades posted to the previous labs or before we start doing more labs?
Mm-hmm. Yeah. The next one that you'll be doing, so there's no lab report due this upcoming week, so I'll be able to get those two back to you before any other ones are due.
Okay.
So the two you've handed in, though, are a little different from the other lab reports we'll be doing, where you're typing out a discussion and a results section and so on, but I'll at least be able to correct any mistakes you made on graphing and forgetting about subscripts and superscripts and things like that. Okay. Fair enough. Yes. I think there actually is one. Yeah. If you go on the lab page, I think there actually is a sample lab report on there for the first time. So, okay. But and on next Tuesday or next Monday, when our lab is, we'll talk a little more about what needs to be in the formal lab report. Okay. Anything else? Well, let's go back to what we ended with. Rutherford's nuclear model, basically a definition of what the insides of an atom looks like, a definition that is still consistent today, even though we now know much more beyond this. Right? People at the LHC, at the Large Hadron Collider at CERN in Switzerland, are smashing atoms together, figuring out what all of these subatomic particles are made of, and hopefully we'll make some important discoveries about even more fundamental things. But for our purposes, the subatomic particles we need to know about are pretty much right here. Let's just draw a quick little picture, though. Got an atom. Center of it, a tiny little bit with most of the atom's mass, and that's called the what?
Nucleus.
And the nucleus contains two kinds of particles. Right? What's one particle in the nucleus?
Protons.
Protons? and neutrons. Protons, as I said up here, have a plus charge. What charge do neutrons have?
No charge.
Okay. Outside of the nucleus is a cloud of what?
Electrons.
And electrons have what kind of charge? I'm glad we know that. In my organic chemistry class yesterday, I had a couple people trying to tell me that electrons were positive. So let's get set off on the right foot right now. Electrons are negative. Yes, good. All right. So let's talk about some numbers that we'll use to define the makeup of an atom. Atomic number and mass number. And I've never understood these abbreviations. I don't know why they couldn't just make atomic number A and mass number M or something like that. But no, atomic number is Z and mass number is A. So I don't know. Those don't make a whole lot of sense to me, so I end up not using those too much. But atomic number itself is a very useful number to us. Atomic number is the same as the number of what?
Protons.
Good. Number of protons in the nucleus. And the number of protons in the nucleus determines what about an atom? Yeah, it determines which element it is. So, an atom of carbon will always have 6 protons in its nucleus, and it's because of those 6 protons that it's carbon, for instance. So we'll look at the periodic table in a second, but the periodic table lists atomic number for us. So that's the fundamental identifier of what type of element it is. So mass number, right, both of these are numbers. When we say something is some kind of number, that means it's exact. So atomic number is an exact number. There's no such thing as 1.5 protons or something like that. So atomic number is exact, and so is mass number. And it's called mass number because it's really, I'll give you a general definition, count of massive particles and in an atom. And relatively speaking, there are only 2 massive particles in an atom. What are they?
Protons and neutrons.
Massive, do you mean large?
By massive, I mean containing a relatively large amount of mass compared to all of the other particles. Right? Number of protons plus number of protons and neutrons have about the same mass, not exactly the same, but about the same mass. All of the other particles in the atom, we'll be talking most about electrons, but even electrons have zero mass relative to protons and neutrons on any measurable scale. They do have some mass, but it's a tiny, 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 tiny fraction of the mass of a proton or a neutron. So that's why protons and neutrons are called massive particles of an atom. So it's just a count of how many particles there are that actually contribute meaningfully to that atom's mass. So number of protons plus number of neutrons. So again, that's an exact number. There's no such thing as a mass number of 12.1 or a mass number of 12.9. Right. We count 6 protons and 6 neutrons, that's a mass number of exactly 12. Does that make sense? So, let's practice our little symbols here. A certain nucleus contains 11 protons and 12 neutrons. Write down on your paper before you say anything, write down on your paper what Z is for that atom and what A is for that atom. Just use these definitions up here. haven't put you in your groups yet. We'll do that in a minute. But I don't know. Somebody on the left over there, or on my left, somebody on your right over there, what's Z equal to?
11.
Works for me. Somebody over on this side here, what is A equal to?
3.
Sense, because it's number of protons and number of neutrons. The number of neutrons doesn't have its own special designator. It's just a number of neutrons. So these two numbers will define one particular atom. So atoms with the same atomic number can have different mass numbers and still be members of that same element, because it's the atomic number that determines that. So in order to define any one particular atom, we use an atomic number and a mass number. So both of those need to be present to make a specific definition of an atom. So, and that's what a nuclide is. It's just a nucleus with a certain atomic and a mass number. A given number of protons and neutrons. So essentially what we did there is defined a certain nuclide. So nuclide is more specific than just saying a certain element. Okay? Carbon can be made out of several different types of nuclides. Okay? So that's what isotopes are. Isotopes have the same atomic number but different mass numbers. So if we have the same atomic number, that means those atoms have the same number of what particle?
Protons.
But different numbers of what? Neutrons. So isotopes have to be members of the same element. So carbon with mass numbers of 12, 13, and 14, those are isotopes of each other. They all have 6 protons, but they have different numbers of neutrons, so different mass numbers. A carbon nuclide and a magnesium nuclide are not isotopes of each other. So isotopes only exist within one certain element. That make sense? So let's do a little shorthand here. A nuclide symbol is a representation of that nuclide. So general format A over Z, then followed by the element symbol. So for our nucleus up here, it's going to be over here, it's going to be 23 over 11. And if we look at a periodic table, I've got one on a couple of pages beyond here. Atomic number is the number on top in each box in the periodic table. So which element is this?
Sodium.
Yeah, right here. Na. 11 is its atomic number. So let's go back to the inch here, 23 over 11. Na is the nuclide symbol for that particular description that we made there. We can have a name for that isotope. I'm about to sneeze. No. Excuse me. But whenever we're defining a certain nuclide, after the name of the element, we put the mass number. So with this information that we have here, sure, we can tell it's sodium, but there's more information. It's the isotope with mass number of 23. So sodium 23 is the best description that we have for this particular nuclide that we referenced. That number right there is the mass number. This has all the same information that does, and that has the same information that it had when we said number of protons, number of neutrons. So same amount of information.
Is it ever appropriate to go like Na-23?
Yeah, sometimes I see that. It's a little more common if you're using the element symbol, to have the two numbers stacked to the left of it, and then to have the element written out with 23 behind it. I have seen Na23, but it's much more common to do it this way. So sodium 24 is a different isotope. What's the difference between sodium 23 and sodium 24? What's different about those atoms? Yeah, sodium 24 has 13 neutrons. Whereas the other one had 12. Turns out that carbon, better color here, carbon has 3 naturally occurring isotopes. So carbon 12, carbon 13, and carbon 14. In nature, those are the 3 naturally occurring isotopes that are found. Carbon 12 is by far the most abundant, so over 99% of carbon atoms are carbon 12. A little less than 1% are carbon 13, and a tiny, tiny, tiny trace are carbon 14. Carbon 14 is interesting because the amount of it decays over time. So if you're going to join us for second semester, at the end of second semester, we'll talk about the rate of radioactive decay. And that's something that can be used to measure the age of substances that were once living. So when things are alive, they incorporate carbon from the food that you eat, from the sugars and carbohydrates that you take in. So as you're constantly respiring, you're bringing in carbon, you're exhaling carbon dioxide, so the amount of carbon-14 is relatively constant within you while you're alive because you're constantly replenishing it. But as soon as you die, you're no longer incorporating carbon, and the amount of that radioactive carbon-14 isotope will slowly decline over time, and that level can be used to determine how long ago it was that you died. So if you're a leaf or a bug or something like that that has become fossilized, for instance, radiocarbon dating can be used to age it. But that only works for things that were once living. There are other methods for aging rocks and stuff like that. Right? So I already mentioned the periodic table a little bit. Here's a commemorative Russian postage stamp with Dmitry Mendeleev on it. Somebody told me what this says, periodic table of the elements, something like that.
That's not it.
Yeah. What does this say? What's that saying?
I have memory since the periodic table from E.I. Mendeleev, it says post office of
Yeah, there's the post office down there. I know it had something to do with periodic table. I know that's Mendeleev right
well,
there.
The first word is
What's
the,
that say?
It's the 100th anniversary.
Oh, it's a commemorative stamp. Add it. There's usually somebody that speaks Russian that can help me out with these kind of things. So, been a while since I took introductory Russian. So Mendeleev, 1869 is the approximate date where he was credited with publishing his idea of the periodic table. So he is credited for being the person that had the most useful arrangement of the elements. So what he did, though, he originally arranged elements in order of atomic weight. So that's something that can be determined experimentally. We use atomic number. Now, a more fundamental value, the actual number of protons within an atom to order our periodic table. But he got good enough information to make the patterns. There, as we'll see on the modern periodic table, there are a couple that are switched around because the weight is a little different due to the different isotopes that are present naturally. But we'll get to that later. So his idea, arrange elements in order of increasing weight. The periodic law, a law, just a summary of observations, remember, he observed that elements with similar properties recur in a regular pattern. So, for instance, if he were to have this string of elements in order of increasing atomic number, we would notice that elements with similar properties recur about every 8 elements. So lithium, sodium, and potassium, for instance, all react with water. Lithium, sodium, and potassium. The ones right before those, helium, neon, and argon, are all unreactive, colorless gases. So that recurring pattern was really what he's credited for discovering. A simple version of a periodic table can be made up by introducing a new line every so often so that elements with similar properties fall into those columns. So, in general, periodic tables are known to have columns. So the columns, we call them groups or families. So I'll be using the word groups most often. So when I say a certain group on the periodic table, I'm referring to a specific column of elements. So on our modern periodic table, there are 18 of them, 18 of those columns. The rows, so each one of these is a row. Those are sometimes called periods. So here's the first period, the second, the third, and so on. And there are consequences for the properties of atoms as we're in a group. Remember I said we'll have similar properties within a group. Properties will change gradually going across a row. Also like that. So on a modern periodic table, the group numbers that will be useful to us will be ones that have a Roman numeral followed by A or B. So if we look at the periodic table that I gave you in your notes here, if you take a look, there's the... Here, I'll zoom in so we can see that a little more clearly. The top row of numbers right here, that's just the group number numbered across 1 through 18. That's just numbering them, by increasing number. Those numbers are not really very useful to us. The ones that will be useful to us in a first semester general chemistry sense are the ones below them that have a Roman numeral followed by either A or B. So the elements in groups that have the A in their group number, like these ones, and these ones over here, refer to those as main group elements. And that dividing line sort of extends down through there. So whenever I refer to the main group elements, I'll be talking about those in the first 2 columns and then the last 6 columns. Those will be very common elements that we'll be using a lot of, much more commonly. We'll be dealing with their electron configurations more, things like that. So those are the main group elements, and notice they have A in their group number. Between the 2 sections, the main group elements are transition elements, which have B in their group numbers. Transition elements go throughout here, that main section. On the bottom of the periodic table are 2 rows, and on this periodic table that we used, we made this periodic table to very clearly show the location of these groups down below. Different periodic tables will differ slightly on which elements are included down here versus up here. Sometimes there are 2 elements here, and then we go down there and so on. So this, I think, is really one of the more... This format is becoming the most common. It's sort of becoming the standard. It's going to look a little different from the one in your textbook sometimes, but when we're doing electron configurations, this way will be far more straightforward for us. when we're dealing with that. And really the subtle differences between whether we have these ones down there or we have these ones up here will not matter to any of the decisions that we'll be making in this course. So might as well have a periodic table that is very straightforward on figuring out where all those electrons are going. So lanthanides, actinides, whenever I think of lanthanides, I always laugh a little bit because on The Simpsons, they were having budget cuts at their school, and they said that their periodic table only has 25 elements, and most of them are lanthanides. So the lanthanides are not a group that we will pretty much refer to at all in this class. Uranium we'll talk about next semester, uranium and plutonium, when we're doing nuclear chemistry. So for us, it's just sort of a novelty. That's not to say that they're not useful overall in the semiconductor industry. Things like europium and samarium, promethium, neodymium, praseodymium, those ones are important, have very important uses. They're added just as in very tiny little amounts to superconductors that change their properties. So without some of those things, we wouldn't have computer chips and stuff like that. But they don't apply much at all to general chemistry. So, but being aware where they are, and we included these right here to show where they actually should be on the periodic table. And the only reason they're not in there is so that we can get a periodic table to fit on one page. There are posters of periodic tables that are wide, and only about that tall and wide, because the lanthanides and actinides can be actually inserted right in here where they belong. So, does that make sense, everyone? Yeah?
Out of curiosity, why do they not have a number, Roman numeral number to them? Is it just...
Because group representations aren't as important in those. Up in the main group, it's very important because fluorine, chlorine, bromine, and iodine have very similar properties. We can talk about them as a group.
Okay.
Right? Most of these we can talk about as a group. Even down in the transition metals, copper, silver, and gold, we can talk of as a group. They have similar properties. But europium and americium have very little in common.
Okay.
So neodymium and uranium have very little in common. So we haven't talked about the number down below them, the atomic mass. We'll get to that in a second. So, on this page, let's see here, let's point out some of the important groups. So alkali metals, group 1A. So, and really starting with lithium, hydrogen is sort of an oddball. Hydrogen technically is in group 1, but it has properties more similar sometimes to those over on the other side. So we won't really include hydrogen with the alkali metals. So lithium, sodium, potassium, and so on are the ones that we'll include. And like I mentioned before, with the periodic law, these all react with water. When we talk about periodic properties later on in this course, I'll bring out samples of lithium, sodium, and potassium, and we'll see how their reactivities are different, and we'll be able to explain why it is that reactivities change going down the periodic table. So that's coming up later on. So 2A are alkaline earth metals, so beryllium, magnesium, calcium, and so on. These pretty much all burn with a bright white flame. In our reactions lab, in 2 or 3 weeks, you'll be able to burn a piece of magnesium yourself and see what that does. Yeah, that's always fun. So, halogens over here, fluorine, chlorine, bromine, iodine in group 7A. Uh, like I mentioned before, those all have very similar properties. Turns out the interesting thing I want to say about the halogens is that that's the only group with all three phases. Now let's call it what we called it before, all three physical states. So let's see if we can figure them out. Fluorine and chlorine are both what?
Yes.
Gases. You know what bromine is? Bromine is kind of special. Bromine, when it's pure, is a brown liquid, really nasty brown liquid that has a high vapor pressure. It gives off a lot of vapor above it. So you'll see in a container a brown liquid, but a whole bunch of brown gas up above it. So at room temperature, it's a liquid. Iodine, when iodine is pure, it is a purple solid. What does that mean about the bottles of iodine that people used to use to treat skin knees and stuff like that?
Not pure.
Not pure iodine. It's iodine that's been dissolved in alcohol, usually. So it's a common misconception to think that's what iodine is. That is a solution of iodine. Pure iodine is a solid, crystalline, purple substance, but has a high vapor pressure too. So you'll have these solid purple crystals that'll be giving off sort of purple vapors if you have them enclosed in a container. So both of these are gases. What's the other liquid on the periodic table? Yeah.
Where's my gray at? No, I have gray.
So only two liquids in standard states on the periodic table. So at room temperature, only two of these elements are liquids. Everything else is solids and gases. So then the last group over here, group 8A, are noble gases. So helium, neon, argon, and so on. Noble gases are unreactive. For the most part. Under very forcing conditions, some of the noble gases down at the bottom, like xenon and mostly xenon, can be forced to combine with other elements and make compounds, but they're very unstable and not naturally occurring. So they're totally stable on their own. That's why we'll see that noble gases exist just as individual atoms. So a sample of helium has just atoms of helium, and that's it. Whereas a lot of the other things tend to make compounds, especially in the nonmetals over here. Okay? So let's divide the periodic table into sort of three major types of elements then. Metals, nonmetals, and metalloids. What is the division? Let's say where on the periodic table is the division between metals and nonmetals? The zigzag, the staircase over on the right-hand side. So it's usually helpful to accentuate that a little bit. This is the dividing line between the metal side of the periodic table and the non-metal side. So things over this side, metals. Over here, non-metals. So let's just talk metals and non-metals for a moment. In general, some green here. In general, metals have a certain set of properties and nonmetals usually have a certain set of opposite properties. So, what's one property of metals?
Ductile.
What's that?
Ductile.
That's the one that always gets quoted. What's ductile mean? Yeah, you can pull it into thin wires. So, that's why copper wiring is possible, that gets the electricity to lights and so on. And every kind of cord, there's copper wire. So ductile, what's the other one that goes along with ductile?
Conducts electricity,
malleable. Important to having wires is that they conduct electricity. Malleable means you can hammer it into thin sheets. That was important for Rutherford's gold foil, right? Gold is especially malleable, which made it uniquely suited for that gold foil experiment, where it had to be so thin that it was only a few atoms across. Metals conduct electricity, and we'll talk later about why exactly that is, but it's has to do with the fact that the electrons are not stationary. Electrons are not isolated on single atoms. Electrons are free to move throughout the entire metal. What do metals tend to look like? Yeah, they tend to be shiny. They're not oxidized. They're shiny when they're pure. They're usually some form of gray or silver or black or something like that. Gold and copper have a little bit of color to them, but most of the other ones are some are colorless to some extent. So they're usually shiny. If you have some pure silver, it can be shiny for a little bit, but what happens to it? Yeah, it tarnishes. It's a reaction with the oxygen in the air, so silver oxide forms on the surface. So that's common to metal. They're usually easily oxidized. Some more than others, but they can be oxidized. So iron can form rust, for instance. Right? Nonmetals, like I said, have sort of an opposite set of characteristics. Instead of conducting electricity, what do? Insulate. They're insulators. And they're not shiny and malleable, they're dull and brittle if they're solids. Or a lot of them are gases. In their pure standard state, there are no gaseous metals. They're either solids or all solids except for mercury. So, write that up there with metals. So, think of dull, brittle solids. Think of things like sulfur, which is a yellow-colored solid that will break when you hit it with a hammer, and it stinks like rotten eggs. Phosphorus, there's white phosphorus and red phosphorus that are tremendously explosive, one more than the other, but still dull, brittle solids. Which all the rest of them are gases. You think of oxygen and nitrogen and fluorine and chlorine. Carbon. What are some of the forms of pure carbon? Graphite is what's mostly in your pencil, so it's dull, brittle. It rubs off a layer of stuff on the paper. There is diamond, which is pure, perfectly crystalline carbon. So not really dull and brittle, but that's why diamond's sort of special. What's that? Coal is just carbon without much structure to it at all. So when you burn something and you have that soot or that just black junk left over, that's just carbon. So, all right. So we got metals, we got nonmetals. The metalloids, for the most part, are the ones that are on the border. So let me circle the metalloids that you should know. You should know boron, silicon, germanium, arsenic, antimony, and tellurium. Two sort of exceptions here. Aluminum is not a metalloid. Aluminum is a metal all around. Aluminum fits all of our descriptions for metal. It's shiny, it's malleable, right? You have aluminum foil, it conducts electricity, all that sort of stuff. So aluminum all around is a metal. Polonium and astatine, their AT, those are a little different because they're radioactive and they're not found naturally occurring nearly as much as the others. So I don't really know whether to call those metalloids or not. People disagree about that, and it's not important to us. But logically, if metals are on one side and they have their properties, Non-metals are on the other side. They have their properties. What should you say about the properties of metalloids? Yeah, they're somewhere in between. They can have properties of metals and non-metals. They could have one property that's sort of in between, so-so, right? So can have properties of both. For instance, silicon. You engineering guys should be able to tell me a little bit about silicon's properties.
It's a semiconductor.
Yeah, silicon is a semiconductor. Meaning it's not a conductor like a metal, but it's also not an insulator like a non-metal. It can, depending on the conditions, can be made into a transistor or something like that that can either conduct or insulate or something in between. What's below silicon? Germanium? Germanium is another semiconductor used as, at least used to be used as one of the ingredients in making things like photovoltaic cells and light sensors and things like that. So depending on the light that's shined on it, it will either conduct or insulate. So semiconductor is very important for technology, for engineering, and so on. Ready? Any questions about any of that business? Yeah, go ahead.
Does that just conduct? Does it not conduct electricity like other metals, or does it not do any of the other properties of metals?
It is a metal all around, except for the fact that it's liquid at room temperature. So the only real difference from it and the other metals is its melting point, essentially. So mercury, does mercury conduct electricity?
Yeah,
absolutely. The way that all thermostats used to be, right? Remember the thermostats where you actually turned the thing on them? Now they just have all buttons that you push. But a thermostat where you actually turn a thing has a little bulb with mercury in it that will either close a circuit or disconnect the circuit, depending on how it's sitting, depending on its orientation. So, yeah, mercury conducts electricity very well.
What's its
freezing? Oh, that's a good one. Put me on the spot. I don't know mercury's freezing point. It's less, I think it's less than 100, less than negative 100, let's see, I think. Oh. Which is interesting because did any of you ever watch MacGyver when it was on? Back in one of the older seasons, he and this other guy were trying to move this bomb that had a mercury switch in it. So it was a tamper-proof thing where the mercury was just in a little pool on the center, and if it tilted to the side, it would connect with the wires. So they got the clever idea of spraying some refrigerant under there and freezing the mercury so they could move it without tripping wires. So using some kind of cleaning fluid or something like that. That's our first MacGyver reference of the semester. Alrighty. So what we had on the periodic table, what we were looking at, were assumed to be neutral atoms. So neutral in their charge, in that they have the same number of protons and electrons, same number of pluses and minuses within those atoms. That's what we assume to have when we're just looking at an element on the periodic table, right? Ions, though, exist just as commonly, and in a lot of elements more commonly than neutral atoms. They exist by having a different number of positive protons and negative electrons, right? So they carry some sort of overall positive or negative charge. And depending on whether it's a metal or a non-metal, either a positive or a negative ion will be more likely to form. So metals usually lose electrons to form positively charged cations. So a cation is just something with a positive charge to it. So be aware of that definition. I always look at the T in the word cation that looks like a plus sign. So remember it that way. So cations are positive. Metals will lose some electrons to form positively charged cations. So let's take a look at sodium. If I start with a neutral atom of sodium on the periodic table, first of all, how many protons does every sodium have?
11.
So sodium with 11 protons. And if it's neutral, how many electrons does that mean it has?
11.
Now, remember what I told you about the noble gases over on the right? What did I say about them? They're unreactive, which means they're stable. Okay? As they are in their state, they have low energy. They don't want to change into something else. They're stable. They're happy the way they are. So sodium, it has 11 electrons. Sodium can also become more stable by having its electrons look like the nearest noble gas. So what's the nearest noble gas to sodium if we're counting by atomic number? Yeah, you don't want to go all the way up to argon when you could just go backwards to neon, right? Neon has how many electrons? Neon has 10 electrons. So when we do electron configurations later, we'll see why this is. But it turns out that having 10 electrons makes an atom stable. Also having 2 electrons, or 18, or 30, what does that say, 36, 54? Those noble gases have special arrangements of their electrons that make them stable. And we'll investigate that a whole lot in the future in here. So, but what we need to know to form simple ions is to make their electrons the same as a nearby noble gas. So what will sodium do in order to get neon's number of electrons? Yeah, it'll lose an electron. So if I have a neutral sodium, here's a reaction arrow that separates before from after. If I start with a neutral sodium, and if it loses one electron, I'll end up with two products. If I start with the sodium and it gets rid of an electron, what are the two things that I'll have? Well, I'll have... let's start with an electron, right? If I start with the sodium and I remove an electron from it, after this change, I'll have whatever the sodium became, plus I'll have one electron that it lost. Okay, so let's just start with that. By losing one electron, do I change the element? Do I change sodium into neon? No, because what determines that?
Protons.
I'm not touching protons. Okay, so I still have sodium, but how is that sodium different now? Positively charged. And why is that? It still has 11 protons, but now how many electrons does it have? By removing one electron, we now have an excess of one positive charge. Right? Does this process make sense to us right here? What we're left with is, let's call it a stable sodium cation. Turns out when sodium is pure, it's sodium atoms. So, like I mentioned before, later on when I'll bring out a sample of sodium and react it with water, that'll be neutral sodium atoms. When is sodium Na+? When is sodium a sodium cation?
Sorry.
Yeah, think of sodium chloride. Things like that. When sodium is in a compound, it's Na+. So let's just make a quick little note of that with my blue here. This is pure sodium. This is in compounds. That'll be a key thing for us to understand. That's hopefully something you got out of introductory chemistry. But sodium when it's pure is sodium neutral. Sodium in a compound is Na+. That's why sodium chloride does not explode when you put it in water. Pure sodium, right, it fizzes, and if you have a big enough piece of it, it'll blow up when it goes in water. Okay? Sodium chloride, table salt, it just dissolves. So changing those electrons changes the properties quite a bit. And what did I say happened to that sodium? It became more stable. Right? If something is unstable, it wants to react. So neutral sodium is actually unstable. I put it in water, it will fizz and spark and react. Na plus is more stable. So I dissolve in water, I pour it in water and stir it up, it just dissolves. That makes sense? So it's a common misconception to think that everything that's neutral is happy and stable, and something with a charge is unhappy, unstable. It's totally the opposite with a lot of things like metals especially. Most metals are more reactive when they're neutral than they are when they're an ion within a compound. That's kind of interesting, right? Well, I mean, that's even why iron rusts, right? If I have some pure iron, that's Fe that's just neutral. When it rusts, I have iron 2 plus or iron 3 plus. I have an ion that's involved in a compound with oxygen that's more stable that way, right? So if metals lose electrons, nonmetals usually gain electrons. Looking at the layout of the and there are exceptions to this. Right? We'll learn as we go along there are usually as many exceptions as there are rules, but let's start out with the generalities. Metals usually lose their electrons. Nonmetals usually gain electrons. Just from the layout of the periodic table, why is that? Why would it be that metals usually lose electrons and nonmetals usually gain electrons?
Because metals are closer to the noble gases.
That's exactly right. Right. The nearest noble gas to things like these ones are behind them on the periodic table. We got from sodium to neon by removing one electron. We stepped backwards on the periodic table, essentially. Mm-hmm. Yeah, so we'll deal with valence electrons later on. Nonmetals, in order to get those stable numbers of electrons, if we had something like nitrogen or oxygen or fluorine, we need to gain some more electrons in order to get to neon's number. So that's why that happens. Let's do chlorine. Look at chlorine right there. What's chlorine going to do to electrons to become more stable? Yeah. If chlorine has 17 and argon has 18, chlorine will gain one electron. So if I were to write that as a reaction with reactants and products, what should I do? Chlorine what? Chlorine becomes something or? Yeah. Don't forget about that electron. Chlorine plus one electron. That's gaining. Becomes what? Cl negative. What do you notice about the overall charges on the left-hand side and the right-hand side of this equation? Here's a minus. Here's a minus. Look up here. What do you notice about the overall charges on both sides of this one? Here's no charge. Here's a minus and a plus. What's a minus and a plus make? Yeah, zero. The charges need to be balanced on both sides of an equation when you're writing something like this. Right? So it turns out that sodium is more stable as Na+, chlorine is more stable as Cl-. If we're thinking of a compound like sodium chloride, that's forming, where do you suppose chlorine would get that one electron that it needs?
Sodium soda.
Yeah, look at that. Sodium wants to give away an electron. Chloride wants to gain an electron. If we have those two elements together, that electron and that electron are the same electron. It's being transferred from one to another. So we'll write that out more a little bit later. So here's our general rule. Main group elements tend to form stable ions with the same number of electrons as the nearest noble gas. So I'm going to give you a couple of them. Let's do calcium. Let's do nitrogen. Let's do aluminum. Let's do selenium. Okay. I'm going to put you in groups. I would like you to, for these four, write reactions, right, with reactants and products and an arrow that shows what these elements do to form their stable ions. So use the periodic table. Use those as an example. So groups. There's only two groups here. You can join whichever one you want. Groups of three. Three, four, and four. Okay? One, two, three, four. Right here is the dividing line. Okay? So, those are four of them right there. I want you to just write those types of reactions. It's called an electron transfer reaction. Write those out for those four elements right there, and we'll compare.
It depends. I think that one spontaneously you have to add a certain amount of energy to get it started. But as soon as it starts going back, it's your energy. As soon as it starts, it will release enough energy to continue. It's pretty normal for ionic compounds to be more stable than the two elements that they do. And when you're checking your work, the metals should look sort of similar, and the non-metals should look sort of similar to what's happening. So see if you can see that pattern.
Alrighty, group over here to my right, a representative. What do you say for calcium? What did calcium mean? Calcium what?
Calcium.
Arrow?
Into Ca2 plus 2 plus 2.
That's good. Did calcium gain or lose electrons? Yep, calcium lost two electrons to make Ca2+. Good. I'm sorry? It's called ionization, where one thing forms a charged compound. It's not really decay, because decay usually is used for one element turning into a different element, radioactive. Alrighty. Next group, you folks over there. What do you say for nitrogen? Nitrogen, then what? Plus three electrons makes what? Nitrogen. Three minus? What did you say? Okay. You folks over there, what did you do with aluminum? Okay, that's good. It doesn't matter which order you write reactants and products. So, in the front here, selenium, what did Se do?
It's
going to
gain two electrons.
To make?
Se.
Yeah. Okay. You guys aren't off the hook. You're next for the next one. So, this makes sense to everybody? Whenever we're in the main group, and what did I use to define main group? What do their group numbers have up on the top? Yeah, main group elements are all the A ones. So first two and the last six. We're in the main group, for the most part, our generalization is such that it's going to go whichever direction gets us closest to a noble gas. And that will be the most common ion that it forms. We'll do something totally different with transition metals. We'll do something different with even these metals down here on the bottom of the main group. But for the most part, our generalization works. Okay? Questions? Done. Let's switch gears a little bit and talk about a measurement that can be made from elements. Atomic mass is a measurement. It's something that is obtained by literally measuring using some kind of equipment to make a measurement with some amount of uncertainty. Atomic mass is just the relative mass of an atom with an appropriate mass unit. So AMU is the atomic mass unit. There is a movement to start calling that the Dalton. So abbreviated with a lowercase u, I don't know, but AMU is what I've always used anyway. So here's the definition of AMU. There are 12 atomic mass units as the mass of a single carbon-12 atom. So they took one isotope, carbon-12 is the most common isotope of carbon. They said that its mass is 12 atomic mass units. So what is the approximate mass of one proton? One AMU? And what's the approximate mass of one neutron? Is the mass of a proton exactly one AMU? No. Protons and neutrons have slightly different masses. They only use this to sort of calibrate what a atomic mass unit is.
That's why it says relative mass.
Absolutely. All other atomic masses will be relative to this definition. So this is the only exact atomic mass there is. Pretty much every measurement system has one exact measurement that defines it, and everything else is relative to it. So, for instance, the inch has an exact measurement to it. 1 inch is exactly 2.54 centimeters, and every other measurement in inches is relative to that definition. So how on earth do you measure the mass of an atom? You can't put it on a tiny little balance, but you can do sort of like J.J. Thompson that had the cathode ray tube. I remember he put magnets up on either side and it sort of deflected the path. You can do that with atoms, turns out. What you have to do, you inject a sample of whatever atom it is, if it's neon gas or whatever, you inject it in there. It flows through a beam of charged particles, so a beam of actual electrons that give those a charge. It turns them into some kind of ion. So it adds an electron to them or removes an electron from them. Different ones behave differently. So an electric field then accelerates the particle. This is actually what happens in particle accelerators, like at CERN and Fermilab. They have charged particles that get accelerated by electric fields that zip them along really quick. Then, got two magnets here. It's an electromagnet, essentially, that can vary the field. And depending on the mass and charge of those particles, they'll be deflected by a certain amount by those magnets. So there's a detector over here that just listens for when something hits it. By changing this magnetic field, you can change the trajectory of those atoms. So you'll get to a certain magnetic field where those atoms are just right, so they're hitting the detector. So that's how you can figure out what the actual it gives you a mass to charge ratio, but if you're confident that you have a single charge, you can actually measure the mass of something. It's pretty much identical in theory to how J.J. Thompson got the mass to charge ratio of an electron, except now we just do it with atoms in order to measure those. And we can do this with molecules too. Big groups of atoms, they can go into a mass spectrometer to figure out what their mass is, and that can help to identify them, for instance. So if you have a mixture of particles that you put in there, the output of the mass spectrometer will tell you how much of each mass that you had. So take a look, for instance, let me draw for you a little bit, it's called a mass spectrum, what it would look like for a sample of natural neon. So out of a mass spectrometer, it's really very simple. You inject the sample, you click collect, and after a few minutes, a computer screen shows you a graph that has abundance over here, right? So it's like the percent of your sample, and down here, M over Z. So it really is a mass to charge ratio, but there are ways that you can ensure that it only has one charge to it, so it's mass just over one, so atomic mass. So here's what neon would look like. I put a scale down in the bottom, so I'm going to make a big peak here at 20. With a fractional abundance of 0.9051. What would it mean if you had something with a fractional abundance of 1?
That was pure.
Yeah, that's pure. That's it. There's only one peak. Fractional abundance will always, all of the fractional abundances of the peaks will always add up to 1. Yeah. So this is 90.5% of that one. 21 will have a tiny little peak, 0.0029. 22 will have a slightly bigger peak, 0.0922. So, what have I just detected about a sample of natural neon? Yeah, it has one isotope that is major. Okay? Neon 20 is its main isotope, but what else? Two other isotopes, 9% of neon 22 and 0.2% of neon 21.
Which element has most isotopes?
The most isotopes. Yeah, that's a good question. I can say this, most elements don't have more than two or three isotopes that are measurable. There are some metals. I'm thinking of things like cesium metals that are down on the lower left that have more isotopes than normal, but I don't know which one has the most. Most elements will have one primary one. There are a couple that have two that are about the same. Bromine has 79 and 81 that are about 50-50. So, but most of the elements have one primary one. And in almost all cases, we have one primary one and several less important ones that are more massive. It happens, but it's less common to have less massive isotopes than the main one, for whatever reason. So let's take this data, okay, fractional abundances as well as atomic masses. Here's that same data. My scale down in the bottom was just rounded to the nearest AMU. Mass spectrometers can record masses very precisely. So the data I got went out to 3 decimal places, but really good mass spectrometers can go out to like 6 or 8 decimal places in atomic mass units. So we've got 3 isotopes, the accurately recorded masses. How come neon 20 isn't 20 AMU? Yeah, we're relative again to carbon-12. We have a different ratio of protons and neutrons. Also, there are other slightly massive particles that influence the mass a little bit. So, remember the protons and neutrons are most of the mass. So, between the ratio of those and other stuff, we get similar numbers, but not quite. So, if I multiply the fractional abundance by those atomic masses, get your calculator. We're going to be able to get a weighted average. When you do a weighted average, you have some number multiplied by its abundance, by its proportion, essentially. So multiply those 3 numbers out. Group right here in front of me, what'd you get for the first one? 18 point something? Let's give plenty of digits because we're gonna add these up. So 18.0947, something like that? 48? Okay. You guys over here to my right, what'd you get for the second one?
0.056684.
Okay. Group in the middle, what'd you get for the third one?
2.02757.
Okay. So those are weighted masses. Okay. Don't think of weight in terms of like measuring weight or something. They're weighted by their abundance. So if 90% of the mass comes from those neon 20, then its weighted mass is that. So we add up the weighted masses. So add those 3 numbers up. You're going to get a number. Group in the back over there, give me a number to 2 decimal places. 20. Everyone agree with that? This is the weighted average atomic mass of the natural isotopes. Of neon. Simply, I can abbreviate this as atomic weight. Take a look at your periodic table and take a look at neon. What do you notice? Okay, this is the number on the periodic table. If I have a collection of neon atoms, on average, the mass of those atoms will be 20.18. We can't just take the average of those 3 masses because they're not in the same proportion. They're not in the same amounts. When you have different objects in different proportions, you have to make a weighted average. So you have to have the most contribution from those that you have the most of, and tiny contributions from those that you only have a tiny little bit of. So the atomic weight of neon is a little over 20 because we have mostly neon 20, but a little bit of the more massive isotopes. Does that work for you guys? So if we ever have abundance data like this, you just multiply them and add them up, and you get a weighted average. And that's where those numbers on your periodic table come from. Okay? Questions? All right, time to go. See you on Monday. Ready for the quiz? Ready for microscale density in the lab?